Okay, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. My name is Ali Gharib, and I am a New York-based senior editor with the blog Open Zion, which is on the Daily Beast website. And I am recording right now from just outside Washington, D.C., and I am on the line with Mossab. Mossab, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, I am Mossab El-Shami. I am an Egyptian freelance photojournalist based in Cairo, and in Cairo at the moment. My work has appeared in Time, Harper's, The Economist, Foreign Policy, and Al Jazeera, and I just came back from Gaza.
Okay, so since we have the benefit of having Mossab on the line, and he is in Egypt where there's lots of action now, we'll get to that topic in a minute, but first we're going to start with Gaza, and as some most viewers I'm sure know, there was until late last week an 8-day war between Hamas and various other Palestinian militant factions based in Gaza and Israel, and the war basically played out with Israeli aerial bombardment from F-16s and drones, shelling from both land outside Gaza and Israel, and from the sea, and also, I said drones already, didn't I? And then so on the Palestinian side, the attacks happening were mostly sort of crude to slightly more sophisticated, but still not entirely the state-of-the-art missiles that were being sent from the Gaza Strip into Israel. The casualty count by the end of the day was I think about 160 on the Palestinian side and 6 on the Israeli side. 4 of the Israelis killed were civilians, and in Gaza that proportion was close to about the same. But there were many of the deaths in Gaza were civilians as well. So Mossab, you were just there and taking photographs. You wrote in your post for us that you did on Open Zion about being a photographer in this conflict zone. You wrote that you got into Gaza through tunnels. So if you could explain how you got in and snuck in, I guess that would be very interesting to me.
Yeah, I had moved to Rafah right as the war was starting to flare up, and going to Gaza from Egypt through tunnels isn't actually, I mean, it sounds like the illegal, obviously it's sort of illegal, but it is the easiest and kind of the most efficient way to get into Gaza, especially at times of crisis. So I went to Rafah city, which is right on the border separating Egypt from Palestine, and there is a huge network underground connecting the Gaza Strip to Egypt after being denied normal entry from the Egyptian side of the border. I had to go through a tunnel, and it was a 5-minute drive that a 5-minute walk kind of underground, but it took about 6 hours until we were able to actually secure one, because Israel largely targets these tunnels. I mean, they target them on a regular basis, but especially during the war, they're always targeted, and there are drones hovering above the tunnel area throughout. So it was very dangerous, and most of the tunnel workers had shut down theirs from the Egyptian and Palestinian side. We were able to get in through the only functioning tunnel. Of course, we were charged large amounts because they take huge risks allowing people in. But at the same time, we had the permit. I say we because I went in through with some other journalists. And we had already gotten permission from Hamas, because even if you go through a tunnel there, there's always someone going to be waiting you on the other side. And so, yeah, it seems just like an official route to Hamas. There is a tunnel authority. Most of the tunnel owners have to coordinate with Hamas at first before allowing goods or people in. So while it was kind of scary and illegal, it was still normal in a way.
Yeah, and in fact, the tunnels have become a main transit point for economic goods and foodstuffs as well. And like you said, Hamas is the tunnel authority, and they charge taxes on
True.
items that pass through the tunnels. So, and you wrote in your post on Open Zion that for you this was a new experience, despite having covered the Egyptian protests and demonstrations and the revolution there and the clashes that entails. This sort of open war with hot weapons that was a consistent hot war with large weapons going back and forth was different, and it sounds like it started right from the second you got in there, that these tunnels were sort of a big risk.
Yes, it was a very big risk, and like I also said, I didn't know what to expect because it was my first actual war to cover. I've been covering the conflict, I wouldn't say a conflict, the protests here in Egypt, and I kind of knew how to always be safe around here because it never. I mean, there were instances when there was brutal force during the revolution and afterwards by the police or the army, but you always knew where the fire was coming from. That wasn't the case in Gaza. Right as we arrived to Rafah City, the house opposite us was bombed, and the place where we were staying in was slightly affected. The glass had been broken, and there was this slight shaking and stress. So the thing that's the most dangerous aspect about Gaza, not just a war. I mean, in Gaza specifically, is that you don't really know where the fire is coming from, whether it's coming from the sky or through the navy or warships. You can't be 100% safe, and that was always the big risk.
Yeah, and so you came in and you went to you went to Rafah City on the Gaza side, and then from there you traveled all over the strip.
Yes. Rafah is I mean, it's always Rafah is one of the most underdeveloped areas in Gaza and also in the Egyptian. It's actually a city which is separated by the border. There are some families in Rafah whose relatives are in the Egyptian side and vice versa. So and also because of the tunnels and because it gets frequently bombed, it's a largely deserted area, and it's very. And during the war, you can imagine how empty it was. We stayed the night in Rafah and didn't want to stay there for long. We started traveling through different areas of the city. I mean, the strip. And every city in Gaza is unique in its way. Khan Yunis is filled with refugee camps, and Gaza itself, it has very modern buildings. It has obviously the sea is there. It's kind of a coastal city, and there are also lots of refugee camps there. We kind of just kept traveling around because in Gaza you can't always. There is a lot happening around, and you can't always photograph what you want, but you have to always follow what's going on. And there is no front line. There is always so much going around you, and you had sometimes go back to Rafah to cover something. You had to go to the different hospitals. There are about 20 hospitals in Gaza the Strip, not to mention the private ones. So we just had to keep going around.
And was traveling around difficult? I mean, did you encounter like a and for those viewers who don't know, Hamas is the ruling authority in Gaza. They won the Palestinian elections in 2006, and then were immediately put under sanctions by Israel and the West because Israel and many countries in the West, including my country, the United States, consider Hamas to be a terrorist group. So sanctions were immediately imposed on Hamas. And then in 2007, there was a U.S. and Israeli-backed coup plot that was meant to overthrow the elected Hamas government and reinstall the Fatah Party, which is a historic Palestinian national movement party, and which now rules the Palestinian Authority, which is based out of the West Bank. And Hamas got wind of this coup and launched a preemptive counter coup and violently seized power in the Gaza Strip. And there was a lot of sort of throwing Fatah guys off of buildings. And that's how they took power in the Strip, which they maintain to this day. There's been several attempts at national reconciliation, but that hasn't happened yet. And Gaza rules the Strip and effectively rules it by force. And so I'm wondering if when you were traveling between these cities in Gaza, if you encountered Hamas checkpoints or if the Hamas military presence was clear throughout the Strip.
Yeah, I just want to say that this wasn't my first time in Gaza. I had been there a month ago. There wasn't a war, so it was interesting because I got to see Gaza during a war and on regular and normal situation, and it was completely different. I mean, on our first visit, there were checkpoints all over the city between different cities, and in Gaza, that you would find presence for security. There would be patrolling troops going around all night. The city was very stable and very safe. You could walk around all night, and it was crowded until after midnight. But during the war, obviously, every Hamas member is a target, and this had led to an almost empty state with no security presence, or the checkpoints were there, but no one was patrolling, but even between cities, there was no presence of security, and obviously the army, which is the Qassam military brigade, they were, you know, in their own areas launching rockets, so you don't really see these guys in any situation. But for the regular state presence, you really couldn't feel any. And there were many instances on our first visit before the war where we were told to go somewhere and not being allowed into others. But during the war, you really can just go around wherever you are because there is no any presence of someone to tell you not to.
That's really amazing. I mean, it's totally counter-instinctual, because you'd expect that during the war the security presence would be beefed up. But as you say, I mean, it's not like these guys could man standing checkpoints, because the second they man the checkpoints, they would just be sitting ducks for
exactly
for Israeli missiles, basically.
Yeah, there is also the fact that even government buildings, I mean, not just police, but when we went to Gaza, we were staying with some friends, and there was a government building there. I think it was part of the financial of the Ministry of the Finance, the Hamas Ministry, and it was bombed. So even not just police, but any member of the government had to lay low for a bit, and this is why there seemed to be no state at all there.
Yeah, that's really a fascinating distinction, and that is something that's been talked about in the news, especially with the Israeli targeting of journalists, or what Israel considers supposed journalists. And this was a controversy that's arose last week and has been revived because a New York Times media columnist named David Carr wrote about it in yesterday's paper. And he was writing about the fact that there were two men working for Hamas-run news organizations, which at least one of them, the IDF, has said he was actually a military operative who was only posing in the civilian job. But it's the same idea that Israel considers everyone from the Hamas organization, whether or not they have a civilian role or not, to be a military target, because Hamas as a whole is a terrorist organization. And so so that leads to the sort of things like where bombing the finance ministry and so on. Did you find that, I mean, I'm sure you were encountering people, either supporters of or members of Hamas along the way. Was there a real climate of fear that even if they had civilian jobs, if they were working for the Hamas government, that they might be targeted?
We were able to meet actually a number of what they call the Murabitun or the Watchers. They are part of the Qassam Brigade, and we were allowed to briefly interview them and take photos of them. Obviously, they were all masked, and they were patrolling the borders of Gaza, and they had to have no phones on them, no iron material at all, because that might lead to their assassination. So it was very amusing to see most of them actually either underground or just working in the dark. There were Hamas supporters and or even those in Hamas families, not necessarily combatants, just friends of Hamas leader or something, and they also had to lay low. Just young people, probably just still studying, or like the example you said, he was also working in the media, but any Hamas tie made these people a target, and you can imagine how endangered their life was. So there was almost no existence of a Hamas presence or even their supporters on the street.
Yeah, and I thought, well, Blogging Heads viewers can check out the article you wrote for us, which is called "Shooting Gaza." It's on openzion.com, and it really was quite a moving piece you wrote for us, and I really appreciated it. And what you talked about was the role of the photographer in these conflicts and the way that because of the incredible human tolls, and this is not just Hamas, but also the wider civilian toll. Several dozen children were killed on the Gaza side of the de facto border with Israel, and there's a real human toll. And you wrote about capturing that and how there's a really delicate balance that you have to kind of tiptoe along between being someone who is there with the role of recording it for history, and also someone who is a human being seeing these things and often horrific sights. And you said something that really struck me, that you spent more time in morgues than you will ever be able to come to grips with. And so if you could speak a little bit to that experience of being around death and the human toll that these sorts of conflicts take, I would certainly be fascinated to hear it.
What I found in Gaza is during the days of the war, when the city was almost shut and there were no people in the street fearing for their lives, ironically, the most places where you would find signs of life were the morgues, and sometimes the cemeteries. And this also struck me, because for you to have people to shoot and interview, you had to go to them at, the most uncanny times, when they were either with their loved ones who they had lost, or burying a relative, or spending last minutes in morgues. And this was very touching. I mean, in the morgue, it really is a very difficult experience, because there are just loads of families there, all of them trying to sometimes identify their relatives who had just come from under the rubble. There were those who had identified and were in the process of wrapping their relatives in the Palestinian flags and about to bury them, take them out in cars and go to the cemeteries. And as a photographer, you really had, there were all these stories around you, and people that are just at their weakest moment, if we could say. And even though you want to make their stories known, you don't want to really intrude on their privacy and such moments. and not to mention asking them who their relative was, and you know, trying to set some interview or mini interview to know more about the subject you're with. And as for someone who had almost, like I wrote in the article, successfully avoided the scenes of death even during very violent clashes in Egypt, this was also very it was a new experience and a very stressful one for me, because it was my first time seeing people in refrigerators in morgues, and trying not just seeing that, but also under some kind of responsibility to get the story out there, because this really isn't about a war. These are mainly civilians who found themselves to be victims of such force, and they really had no much say in this, especially the children. I mean, most of the casualties, a huge number of the casualties during the war were children under 10 years. And there's always, you know, a responsibility, like I said, for you as a photographer to remember these children, and also to make the world remember, because this is huge injustice, no matter who you stand with. And as a photographer, you really have to just take the story out there to the reader, who also has a responsibility to know. So yeah, that was very difficult for me at first, but then it later became the normal, just to wake up and head straight to the morgue to try and get the stories out there of the families and the new death toll, which would always arrive during the day, but would always, you know, leave the morgue the next morning, and you have to be there.
Wow, I can't even imagine doing that as someone who's who's done reporting mostly here in the U.S. and mostly in D.C. at that. I can't, you know, that's something for me, that sort of conflict reporting is something I can't really imagine. And it really is, it's a much more intensely human story than anything I've ever reported on writing about international relations and politics. And particularly the angle about children, because as you say, you know, no matter what side you're coming from, the dead children really is emotionally resonant because of the innocence of children. And, you know,
yes, exactly.
You can make the argument that a guy who works for a Hamas-run radio station is also a Hamas military operative, but there's no argument to make to justify the death of a child under 10.
Precisely.
But you also, you know, some of the photographs that you had in a gallery that we put up at the Daily Beast showed that despite the fact that their schoolmates were perishing under the rubble of these buildings collapsed by Israeli bombs, there also seemed to be a sort of not a normalcy, but a normal kind of childhood attitude to the children that were still out in the streets. You had one picture that's up on Open Zion right now is of children playing in a what looks like is that a schoolyard?
Yes, that's a UN school in Shatte. It's the beach camp in Gaza, and it was a very it was a great experience, because I mean, not just photography wise, but even on a personal level, because after 3 days of following death and rubble and destruction from place to another, we just kind of went there to meet some people, and it was very refreshing to see life kind of, you know, people trying their best to move it on. These were kids in playing football at a UN school made for the children, for the refugee children in the Shatte camp, and it just struck me how nonchalant they were about the drones buzzing above them and the sound of rockets being launched, whether launched or falling on places near them. They would actually cheer at rockets going from their side or and also for those coming. So it also struck me, because these people have been witnessing, and I mean, these children, they were all from 5 to 15 years, and this wasn't their first war. I mean, they must have encountered the one that was 3 years ago, and not to mention the regular bombardment that that occurs in Gaza during non-war situations, and they just seem to have mastered, like I said, the art of living. They just want to keep living, and they want to enjoy life. They were actually playing a football game there, and then they started posing for the camera with victory signs and chants and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And yes, this is also something very special about Gaza in a way. I mean, the first scene I saw just as I crossed from a tunnel into Rafah was a group of children playing football. And then this 3 days later, they just use every opportunity when things seem to calm down a bit and just enjoy themselves out there. And despite the emotional toll, I mean, there is all sorts of researches on the psychological aspect on children and the trauma they encounter after seeing such scenes of death. I mean, I was just there and I was very affected. So you can imagine how it would be for innocent children. But despite that, you know, just seeing those children, kind of adapting to the situation and enjoying themselves was very refreshing.
Yeah. And so, so we might as well, the war in Gaza, you came back the same day the ceasefire was announced, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So just to explain for viewers, 2 days after Hillary Clinton showed up in Israel and then went to the West Bank and then went to Cairo, it was announced that there was an Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, and the ceasefire entailed that both sides would stop firing at each other, and then there would be further discussions about provisions that would ease but not completely lift the blockade that Israel imposes on Gaza. And so it was sort of this really big moment for Morsi, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, who is a former Muslim Brother and still associated with the movement. And he was elected last year in this sort of young democracy in Egypt. And more on that in a moment. But he brokered this ceasefire between the two sides, and you know, it was really sort of a strange moment when you had the Israeli foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who's very far to the right, you know, publicly thanked Mohamed Morsi. And then you had the American leaders also were very grateful. And, you know, Hillary Clinton was right there standing next to Morsi's foreign minister when they announced the ceasefire together. And it was really, really quite something to see. So do you want to talk? Were you back in Egypt by the time the ceasefire announced, or were you still there and headed back after the ceasefire?
I was actually sort of between Egypt and Gaza during the announcement. So
did you come back by tunnel, or
yes,
came back over?
Yes, I mean, coming by a tunnel means you also have to go through a tunnel because that would cause problems on the way back at the border. Not to mention that you kind of get your name listed on the tunnel authority, you know, since you came in, so you sort of have to leave also through the tunnels. When the ceasefire was announced, I was sort of on my way between Egypt and Gaza, and so I sort of missed on the celebrations that took place right after the ceasefire was announced, and you know, the scenes of cheerfulness and celebration by the Palestinians. There was a very positive attitude here in Egypt towards the role Morsi played for brokering the ceasefire. And Morsi in general has been, if there is one success he's made, it is relatively his foreign policy. And there is much left to be taken on the domestic front, He had also he had a very strong stance against Iran during his visit to Tehran, condemning the regime and supporting the Syrian revolution. And he's also been trying to bridge so many gaps that the Mubarak regime had left between Egypt and other countries, African or not. So this didn't really come as a surprise. Also, his relation with Hamas, which is considered part of the Muslim Brotherhood, meant there was more in common between the regime and the two regimes in Gaza and in Egypt. So this all led to brokering the ceasefire, which was really the natural outcome after, and you know, that everybody was waiting for.
And yeah, and then so after that foreign policy, another foreign policy success for Morsi, you woke up the next morning, you were back in Cairo?
Yes,
and you woke up the next morning, and then there was a total fall down on the domestic front. Do you want to just explain in very general terms so viewers can understand what happened the next morning?
Yes, I believe Morsi had sort of felt in a strong moment where he could take one of his most controversial decisions up to date, which was to grab, you know, more powers than the ones he already had. I mean, with no parliament in place and no constitution being written, Morsi had already, and after sidelining the military last October, Morsi had sort of amassed both executive authority, and following his decree, which was announced right after the Gaza ceasefire, it meant that he practically there was practically no one above his decisions, where he kind of sidelined also the judiciary and provided immunity to all his decisions, which meant they cannot be overturned by the judiciary, which is an independent authority in Egypt. So this was met with a huge response here in Egypt by the opposition. They felt it provided him with dictatorial powers, although he mentions that it is temporary until there is a constitution in place and the parliament gets voted. But this has actually gained him so much power, which is unprecedented in Egypt. And today there was a million-man march organized by the non-Islamist forces in Egypt. And it seems to be his very first real test on the domestic front.
Yeah, and you were out photographing those marches as well. And I should just add that that I'm sure for Egyptians who know their recent history, it's no comfort to hear from your president that these are temporary measures, because after all,
exactly,
the deposed President Hosni Mubarak's state of emergency was supposed to be a temporary measure, and that lasted for 3 decades.
Yeah. So not to mention that we had just come out of a revolution that was mainly against a one-man authoritarian rule, totalitarian rule, I'm sorry. So you really can't in any way justify another president, elected president, who had actually won with a very, very close percentage. He won with 51%. So he didn't win with sweeping support. He was actually supported by many revolutionaries and non-Islamists who felt that a vote for him would be a vote against the ex-regime, and it was the only reason they voted for him, not because they were in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. So he had come in a very polarized scene in Egypt, where the country was still struggling with different ideologies, trying to outlast each other. And to wake up with such decision, giving him practically all sorts of powers in Egypt, was very was not something to be comforted with. Unfortunately, so far he hasn't backed down on his decree, which means that the scene is still going to be tense with more protests, not just anti-Morsi, but there's also pro-Morsi protests that's planned. So the country is going to be going through, this polarization for a bit, and there has already been a
And
number of
those are
casualties.
organized by the Muslim Brotherhood, right?
Sorry? Yes, they're mainly by the Muslim Brotherhood, but also other Islamist forces are also supporting the decision. So this is kind of upsetting that the country is split between Islamists and non-Islamists at the moment, because we really don't want to be divided by ideologies, and we just want to move forward, including everyone. But the scene at the moment is extremely polarized, and unfortunately, some figures of the ex-regime are siding, out of just despise for Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. They're now siding with revolutionaries, so it's easy to taint any opposition as
Old
members of
regime.
ex-regime who are just trying to undermine the president, etc.
Was there any violence during today's protest?
Not in Tahrir Square, but actually there has been violence ongoing in different parts of the country since Mohamed Morsi's decree, and this has left about two people killed. But mainly mobs have been targeting the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters all over the country, and have been setting these headquarters on fire in other governorate in the Delta in Egypt.
Right, I saw that the Brotherhood today asked for the army to protect its various headquarters, which is, a little bit ironic because the army is seen as like the great vestige of the old regime, and because Morsi's move was to sideline the military during the fall.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the army makes an appearance again, actually, because at the moment there is a highly non-functional Ministry of Interior, and the police force are also, I think, undermining Morsi, because it's still largely unchained. It has been a demand during the past 2 years that the police forces be purged, and that the officers who were responsible for killing protesters in January 25 last year be brought on trial. But most of the evidence was destroyed, and even those who stood trial were cleared. So at the moment you have kind of a separate state, which is the police acting with no orders and not protecting people, but actually killing them, and not even able to protect headquarters of the ruling party. So this is
Well,
also quite a challenge for Morsi.
that's an interesting catch-22 you're describing, because actually one of the reasons Morsi gave for his decree was the fact that the judiciary was refusing to public to prosecute members of the old regime, right?
Yes, one
So
of
it's very interesting that now he's faced with this thing where the police is sort of going out on its own, and it's the remaining and he hasn't been able to get rid of these the members of the police who were pro-Mubarak, and is left with basically the structures of his political party all over the country being unprotected as a result.
Yeah, I mean, what
There's some irony there, right?
exactly? And one of the articles in his declaration was to remove the prosecutor general, who was one of the most significant pro-Mubaraks in the country, and he has absolute powers in the sense that he is the one who refers people to trial in Egypt. And because he was largely a Mubarak sympathizer, he allowed most of the evidence that would frame Mubarak figures and those police officers to be brought to a fair trial. So most of them were cleared. And Morsi had already tried, by the constitution, he cannot be removed by Morsi. He has to either resign or die. So Morsi couldn't really, he was faced with the challenge of removing him in order to, provide some sort of justice if there was trials to take place once again. And this has led this prosecutor general to also lead a front against Morsi, because to him, Morsi had gone against the law and the constitution on which he swore on. So there are really all these sort of challenges facing Morsi, whether it's the judiciary led by the general prosecutor or the police, or the protesters on the street, or the pro-Mubaraks who are trying to utilize these protests in their own favor. And the Muslim Brotherhood are trying to do their best to show that there is support for Morsi's decisions. And between all of this, the country is really left in a very tense moment where things could really go out of hand easily.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's an incredibly Byzantine situation of all this political intrigue. I think we're running out of time here, but do you fear that Egypt is returning to a dictatorship?
Not really. I mean, the significance of today's protests, even though this is just about 6 months under Morsi's rule, and it's expected that he would make a lot of mistakes, but the significance of such reaction in less than a week, with the hundreds of thousands in Tahrir Square and others all over the country, is what's always, you know, comforting about this, is that the people are really not going to allow such a dictatorship to emerge once again under any justification. I mean, the justifications Morsi provides sort of makes you at least understand where he's coming from. But the problem is people don't want to justify any signs of dictatorship, because what might be a justification now can be justified later. And like you said, when Mubarak came, he said that the law of emergency is just against terrorism and is temporary, and we ended up with 30 years. I mean, it didn't even get removed until about a few months ago after Mubarak. So this is why I'm confident that the revolution will eventually pass all these tests, and we expected such challenges. And I think with the the upheaval the country is facing, people are also learning, and democracy is slightly developing. So I'm more optimistic than afraid.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to hear that you are upbeat and hopeful. And you know, it's really been a pleasure talking to you here, Mossad.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the story you wrote for us, and you taking the time to chat for Blogging Heads. And really, I do think that I flipped through some of your work, and like the same way that you put hope in the people in the street and the revolution, your work is really focused on on humanizing these scenes that you've been taking pictures of, whether they're protests and demonstrations in Egypt or whether they were covering this brief week-long destructive war in Gaza. You've really put a human face to a lot of it. So thanks a lot for all your great work out there.